OU Israel presents...
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Balak. That is, of course, and I think this is the last Shabbat I will be saying this for this year, we read Balak in Israel, in Chutz La'aretz. This is the catch-up Shabbat where Chukat and Balak are both read. And we are back in alignment, which we've been out of since the second day of Shavuot, which we don't have, and in Chutz La'aretz they do have. So, as a result, they read, meaning people abroad out of Israel, read a special reading for the second day of Shavuot. We did not do that reading. We've had six consecutive Parshat HaShavua, Naso, Balot HaShlach, Korach, Chukat, and this coming Shabbat Balak. And in those same six Shabbatot, one was taken up, the first one by the second day of Shavuot, and the other five, they catch up by doubling up on Chukat and Balak. To be a little bit more honest about the situation, it is not they, in Chutz La'aretz, who catch up to us, it is we who slow down in order to get back into alignment by splitting Chukat Balak, which was scheduled to be combined. Now, that might sound like saying the same thing in two different ways, but it really depends historically on where we got the yearly cycle of Torah reading from, and it seems, from all indications, that it was created for Chutz La'aretz, outside of Israel. In Israel, there was a different system of a three-year cycle. And when we went over to the one-year cycle, there were a couple of situations where it had to be adjusted to accommodate for the fact that we have one day Yom Tov and 7 days of Pesach rather than eight, and one day of Simchat Torah instead of two. And there are various adjustments that needed to be made to the calendar. Be that as it may, we are reading Parshat Balak. That's what I will be focusing on. But I do have something interesting to point out about what reading was missing and will remain missing in Chutz La'aretz this year. And I'll get to that after we take care of our ritual of how we start the show. Today, recording and first broadcast, Yom Chamishi, Thursday, Yud Tammuz Tafshin Samach Tet, the 10th day of Tammuz, 5769, on the general calendar, July 2nd. Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130. Shir Hama'alot Mima'amakim Kraticha Adonai. Adonai Shim'avakoli, Tihyena Aznecha Kashuvot Lakol Tachanunai. Imavonot Tishmoria Adonai Miya Amod, Ki Imacha Hasalicha Lama'an Tivare. Kiviti Adonai Kivita Nafshi, Velidvoro Hocholti. Nafshi l'Adonai, mi shomerim laboker, shomerim laboker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai, ki im Adonai ha-chesed v'harbe imo fedut. V'hu yifde et Yisrael, mi kol avonotav. Acheinu kol beit Yisrael, hanetunim batzara uvashivya, ha-omedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha. Hamakom yirachem aleihem, v'yotzieim mi tzara lirvacha, ומאפלה לאורה ומשיבוד לגאולה, השתה בעגלה ובזמן קריב, ונאמר אמן. Now, I mentioned a moment ago that there is one reading that is missing outside of Israel this year. It is not one of the weekly portions because, as I've already mentioned, the doubling of Chukat and Balak this week outside of Israel brings us back into alignment, and no weekly portion is missed. What is missing is the Haftarah, the reading in the prophets of Parshat Chukat, which we read last week, which this week in Chutz Laretz will not be read because the Haftarah of the combined Chukat Balak is the Haftarah of Balak. And therefore, there is one Haftorah that in Chutz Laretz they miss this year, and ironically, it is one that carries with it a certain message which we in Israel, I think, feel stronger without this reminder, and in Chutz La'aretz, Jews seem to have a weaker grasp on this idea and could have used the reminder. So, with that in mind, the Haftorah that you will not hear this week is the one, the story of Yiftach HaGiladi. The beginning of the story is not germane to the point I want to make, and that is that Yiftach was an outcast in his society. He was half-brother to a large family, and they threw him out. Various reasons. When they needed a leader with military abilities, the community begged that he return, and he said, you hated me, you threw me out of my father's home, why do you come now when you have troubles? And the elders of Gilad said to him, etc., etc. P.S. He came back, and he successfully led the people as governing head as well as military head. That's not the point that I want to call to your attention. Yiftach, and this is the point, Yiftach, as leader of the Jewish people in the area, sent messengers to the king of Bnei Amon, saying, Ma li valach, what's between you and me, ki bata elai lehilachem ba'artzi, that you have come to fight in our land. The king of Bnei Amon sent messengers to Yiftach, and he said, the reason we want to fight against you, ki lakach Yisrael et artzi ba'aloto mi Mitzrayim, because Israel took my land when they came out of Egypt from the Arnon to the Yabok until the Jordan, and now give us back that land in peace. Yiftach sends a messenger back to the king of Bnei Amon, and he says, thus saith Yiftach, Lo lakach Yisrael et Eretz Moav ve'et Eretz Bnei Amon. Israel did not take, did not conquer, does not occupy the land of Moab and of Bnei Amon. When we came out of Egypt, and he tells the story, part of which is from the Sedra, that we asked permission to pass through the land of Edom peacefully. They did not allow it. We circumvented the land. We were told not to attack. And when we came to Moab, same thing. We requested permission. They didn't give it, and we circumvented. When we came to Amon and we requested permission, Amon aggressively attacked the Israelites, who vanquished Bnei Amon and took over that land. So the way the wording goes in the Navi, Israel sent messengers to Sihon, king of the Ammonites, please let us pass through your land up to my place. And Sihon did not trust Israel to pass through his border. And Sihon gathered all his people, and they encamped, etc., and fought with Israel. And God, the God of Israel, delivered Sihon and all his people into the hand of Israel, and they struck them, and Israel possessed all the land of the Amorites, the inhabitants of that land, and they possessed all of the borders of the Amorites, from the Arnon to the Yabok, and from the wilderness up to the Jordan River. And now God has driven out the Amorites from before his people Israel, and you want to possess it? That's the way Yiftach talks back. Are you any better than Balak ben Zippor, the king of Moab? Did he ever strive with Israel, or did he ever fight against them when Israel dwelt in Cheshbon and its towns, etc., etc.? I have not sinned against you, and you do wrong with me by fighting against me. May God, the judge, decide this day between the children of Israel and between the children of Ammon. And it continues, Ammon didn't accept this, and they attacked, and the attack was successfully met. The historic echoes of this chapter in the book of Shofetim, chapter 11, when the world perceives, and the Palestinians, supposedly, the supposed Palestinians, broadcast to the world that we stole their land and occupy their land, our answer is very similar to that of Yiftach to the Bnei Ammon. We did not possess, conquer their land. Our neighbors, Egypt, Syria, and Jordan, attacked, planned a war to destroy Israel, the people of Israel, the Jewish people in Israel, and drive us into the sea. Specifically, Jordan was told at the time, stay out of this war and we won't touch you. And Jordan, because of treaties it had made with Egypt and Syria, had no choice but to join in a war which they lost. Egypt lost, Syria lost, Jordan lost. And the territory that Jordan had been holding on our side of the Jordan River was returned into Jewish hands by the grace of God in the Six-Day War in 1967. Don't come to us and say, we took away your land. We regained the land that was supposed to be ours in the first place, and don't ask us to give it back to you. It's not yours. There are tremendous parallels, of course with differences, between the Haftorah of Parshat Chukat and the reality of today. Now, I say again what I said before. The perception on the part of many people who live here in Israel is right in line with Yiftach's words to the king of Bnei Ammon. The perception that Jews have elsewhere, and some here also, is different, and they seem to accept and to swallow the propaganda on behalf of the supposed Palestinians, and I still say supposed because there really is no such thing as Palestinians. We're talking about Arabs who happen to live in the borders of the land of Israel, and if they want to remain within these borders, they should agree to live peacefully with us as neighbors and not seek our destruction. But that's a whole other thing. The fact of the matter is, the Haftorah of Parshat Chukat had this message of reminder to us, and unfortunately, that's the Haftorah that was missed this year in Chutz Laretz. That, in long form, is what I wanted to say about that before we get into Parshat Balak, which we will do in a moment. But let's begin with a song. The song is from words in Parshat Balak, the famous words of Bilam, which we will talk about later. Matovu Oholecha Yaakov, How goodly are your tents, O Jacob. Let us translate them the way Rabbi Jonathan Sacks from England, Rabbi Sir Jonathan Sacks, translates them in the new Koran Siddur. How goodly are your tents, Jacob, your dwelling places, Israel. That is a pasuk from this week's Parsha of Balak. It was one of the words that came out of Bilam's mouth, and we have to say it like that because he did not want to say these words, this beautiful description of Israel. He wanted to earn his money and curse the Jewish people, and three significant costly attempts to do it all failed, thanks to God's intervention, by telling Bilam what he should say, by putting the words into his mouth. This is why we quote this verse. We're not quoting Bilam, we're quoting God through the mouth of Bilam to remind us that the power of speech is a gift from God, and when a person wanted to misuse it, God had other plans for him. How goodly are your tents refers to the housing and the way the Jewish people set up their tents, respecting each other's privacy, and the sight from the hilltops overlooking the encampment apparently impressed Bilam so that he uttered these and other beautiful words as well. This is the verse that begins the Shacharit davening, and when one enters the synagogue, or even if he prays at home, he recites Matovu Ohalecha Yaakov Mishkenotecha Yisrael. A verse from Tehillim chapter 5 immediately follows, and the song has those words as well. Va'ani Barov Chasdecha Avo Beitecha Eshtachave El Hechal Kodshecha Beiratecha. As for me, in your great loving kindness, I will come into your house, capital U, capital Y, and capital H. I will bow down to your holy temple in awe of you. The connection of these two verses is the concept of Mishkenotecha Yisrael, your dwelling places, Israel. Another interpretation of Mishkenotecha means your sanctuary, the Holy Temple, the Mishkan, the Beit HaMikdash, as well as a Beit Knesset, a place of Jewish prayer. So it is the private homes that he was complimenting, as well as the religious home, capital H, small h, as you will, and it is these two verses that make up this next song. This particular version of it comes from an album called Haneshama Lach 3, Matovu.
Bye.
We'll be right back.
I'm Rod Serling. You're listening to
Torah Tidbits Audio.
Rest your eyes.
We're back with the show for Parshat Balak. Let's get into Parshat Balak. Balak is an extremely easy sedra to outline. Not so easy in its content, but very easy in its outline. And the simplicity of the outline of the sedra is, I think, a very powerful statement. The whole sedra of Balak contains 104 verses, which is roughly the average for the Torah. A little bit below average for the book of Bamidbar, but pretty much an average-sized parsha. It is made up of two parshiot. The first one is a whopping 95 verses. What that means in a Torah scroll is one solid block of text with no breaks. Parshiot are the breaks in a Torah scroll. They come in two forms, a parsha petucha, an open break, and a parsha situma, a closed break. But that which is contained in a parsha, and a parsha could be as small as one verse or even less than a verse, to a handful of verses, to 10, 20, 30, whatever, 95 is an exceptionally large parsha. There are at least two that are even larger than that. They are whole sedras. But let's not get into that. I tend to get off on tangents when it comes to statistics, so I'll try to stay to the point. The first of two parshiot that make up the weekly portion of Balak is 95 verses. That means that however many things happen in the account in this portion, they're all considered to be one, which makes a lot of sense. Balak, the king of Moab, fears Israel, who has recently defeated two kings that were stronger than Moab, stronger than Balak. And he came up with, in the way I like to put it, after doing some research on the topic, he came up with a non-conventional weapon that would hopefully be able to succeed with the more conventional attacks of swords and arrows and spears failed. And that was the power of prophecy, the power of a prophet, the prophet's power to bless and to curse, and that's what he attempted to do. So he turns to Midian, who at the time were enemies of Moab, and he attempts to hire Bilam, a world-renowned prophet, recognized by us, by the way, as one of the prophets from the non-Jewish world. And Bilam's specialty, we'll say, is his ability to bless and curse. And he is being hired at a fantastic fee by Balak to come see the Jewish people and curse them, so that perhaps Moab would be able to survive and even be victorious in a war against Israel. Bilam at first is reluctant to go, and then he goes, and God told him not to, and then God gave him permission, and then God got angry with him. And if Bilam were to have said, "You let me go, you said it's okay to go, what are you getting angry?" This raises a whole other thing, which I don't know if we want to get into, but the idea that when we know that God wants us to behave in a certain way, even if he does not forbid the opposite or does not require that, we are supposed to be intelligent and sharp enough to realize what God wants and to do his will. And Bilam definitely did not. One gets the tension in Bilam that he would really, really love to earn his fee here and curse the Jewish people, and God thwarts him every step of the way. Before he gets to Moab, while he's on the road, his donkey sees an angel standing with a drawn sword blocking the path. Bilam himself does not see that. And the donkey turns off the path and is beaten for his efforts, and then he attempts to squeeze by the angel and catches Bilam's foot against the fence and is beaten by Bilam for it, and then he balks and refuses to go any further when there's no way to bypass, and he gets beaten a third time, and then God gives the power of speech to the donkey to say to Bilam, now these are my own words, but it's appropriate in the common perception of donkey. The donkey says to Bilam the equivalent of, "You jackass, why do you insist on going against what God wants when there's an angel standing in the road blocking you with a drawn sword?" Then Bilam sees the angel and realizes that he's doing the wrong thing, and he suggests that he might return. To which the angel, echoing what God had told him to say and what had already said to Bilam, giving him permission and, in essence, giving him enough rope to hang himself. B'derech she'odam holech molichin oto, in the way that a person goes, God sometimes leads him, even if it's in the wrong direction. So Bilam shows up, and he warns Balak in advance. He is powerless to say anything that God will not allow him to say. And Balak says, "I'll take my chances. Come here, look at the people, and curse them." And Bilam utters beautiful words of praise for the people of Israel. And Bullock gets a little irritated, and Bilam says, I told you, I warned you, it's not going to be that easy. And Bullock takes him to another vantage point, and they build another set of altars, and they offer another set of sacrifices upon the altar. And Bilam once again fails to do Bullock's bidding by cursing the people, instead utters beautiful words of blessing and praise for them. And he knows that he doesn't want to do this, but he is powerless to do otherwise. The powerful message there to him is, when God wants a donkey to speak, the donkey speaks. When he wants a human being to speak, the human being speaks. But he can only say what God wants, in this case of Bilam. And the third time, they go to another vantage point yet, and each place that they are was an attempt to somehow receive God's permission to carry out their plan to curse the Jews, and it just doesn't work. Over and over again, they are thwarted. Bullock throws his hands up in utter frustration, claps his hands, and says, you blew your chance at fabulous wealth. Bilam sort of shrugs off and says, I told you right up front, I can't do it unless God lets me do it, and he's not letting me do it. And then Bilam waxes eloquent again at God's behest, a prophecy of the other nations and of Israel, and he goes his way, and Bullock goes his way. Thus end 95 verses, one portion, 95 psukim, 95 verses in the Torah, that carry with it an important message to us. Now, the additional message to us is, we were totally oblivious to what was going on. Picture in your mind the people of Israel encamped in the wilderness, minding their own business, taking care of their daily chores and their daily activities, unaware that on a hilltop and another hilltop and another hilltop overlooking their encampment are Bilam and Bullock with their entourages, who are attempting to sacrifice to God in order to get God's permission to curse the people. The people are totally unable to defend themselves because they're not even aware of the threat. And it's as if God said, I'll take care of this one. I'm not even going to tell you that you have to expend effort. We're dealing here with powerful, powerful forces of Bullock and Bilam. And God said, you can fight against them, but I will fight for you. And the fact that God put this into the Torah, these 95 verses, is very significant for us, because we get a glimpse at that which, as I said, we were unaware of God's complete and total commitment to us to protect us from the Bilams of the world. And if that were the whole story, we would have a 95-verse single parsha weekly Torah reading called Bullock, and we would finish with a good feeling of God's protection over the people who were busy with their daily operations in their sojourn in the wilderness, and that would be the end of the story. But there are 9 more verses. And in these 9 verses, we see what happens when we don't have God's protection. Not only that we don't have God's protection, we see what happens when we alienate God from his role as protector. And we are talking about the events where the Moabites and the Midianites had their beautiful women seduce men from the people of Israel to orgiastic worship of Baal Peor and participate in idolatry and in immorality. And this was known as the Eitzah, the advice of Bilam, and Bullock will not say who gets the credit for it, But before they parted company, this was their plan of desperation. If we can't harm the Jewish people on our own, let them harm themselves. And the best way to do it is the way they discovered, and it's to have us rebel against God, betray our faith in God, and idolatry and immorality are way, way up the list of those things that can get God angry with the people. And because of that, a plague broke out, and the Torah in very rapid fashion tells us that until the point that the Sedra ends, there were 24,000 casualties from this episode. Contrast that with 3,000 people who were killed because of participation in the Golden Calf fiasco. I don't know how many people died in the rebellion of Korach, but it was nowhere near this. And there's one other episode where the Torah does give us a body count, which was 14,700, and this has it beat by a lot. 24,000 casualties, and they would have continued to mount up and up had it not been for the zealous, enthusiastic action of Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aharon HaKohen, who stopped the plague by taking a spear in hand and killing a major leader of the Jewish people who was involved in acts of immorality and idolatry with a Midianite princess. Their names we know from next week's Torah reading: Zimri from the Shevet of Shimon, the tribe of Shimon, and Cosby from the Midianite princess. And when Pinchas reacted in a way that no one else was ready to do, the Magefa, the plague, stopped, and the death toll is announced to us at 24,000 people. And that's how Parshat Balak ends. So you have a contrast, a 95-verse story of an amazing event that God lets us know about, where we faced a greater threat than we had up till that point, and God protected us. And then a very powerful lesson in the final 9 verses of the Sedra to show us what happens when God's protection is not there, but his anger is instead, kivyachol, so to speak, and a death toll of 24,000, which would have been much higher. It is such a contrast that one can't help but get the message there. And I have written that what it brings to my mind is, on the one hand, how successful the Six-Day War was, how we have continued to succeed in the face of so many, many enemies and numbers more powerful than we, and rockets and missiles, and we see God's protection all the time. And then we see what happens on the roads with the fatality after fatality. I don't think a week goes by that there are not fatalities on the roads, from terrible, terrible driving episodes, mostly. And that's an example of our shooting ourselves in the foot, our killing ourselves, not an enemy from the outside, but because of things we do and things we don't do, then we get punished internally by ourselves. Another message from the Parsha. This past week saw several well-known personalities pass away. The hubbub of Michael Jackson's demise has not ended. Every day in the papers here in Israel and on the internet, Yahoo and other places, and I am sure in papers all over the states, Michael Jackson this, his will, who he favored, who he cut out, where the funeral is going to be, all kind of stuff, including people playing a lot of Michael Jackson music. I was at a Sheva Brachot this past Sunday evening, and they had a guy on a keyboard, and in addition to Hasidic music, he was playing Michael Jackson songs. From our perspective, meaning the Jewish people, we lost in the same time frame a popular, well-known singer of the past, Joe Amar, Zichrono Livracha, and I remember his music from the 60s. He's been around for a long time, not too active in the last number of years, but some very memorable music. Sfardi, so it is not my own ear that reacts to it, but I guess there's a little Hasidic streak in all Misnagdim and a little Sfardi streak in all Jews of any extraction, and an appreciation of the character and the quality of the person and his music. In tribute to Joe Amar, Zichrono Livracha, I would like to play one of his songs, Yismach Moshe. It is based on the passage in the Shabbat morning prayer that speaks of Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, our teacher, who rejoiced in his role of being the recipient on our behalf of Torah, and specifically in this song, of the Luchot, the Ten Commandments, and the tablets, which contain the command to keep the Shabbat. The words of the song are not exactly the words of the prayer, but they are based on the words of the prayer, and this is put on just as a sample of the music of Joe Amar, Zichrono Livracha.
Keter berosho, natata lo, natata lo, natata lo. Isema.
On that note, I wish you Shabbat Shalom, Lehishtameah.